Hey, how's it going?
Hello.
We'll see if Skype actually lets us talk.
Yes. That's kind of rare.
All
Is it
right.
feedbacking on you?
No, I'm just fine.
Oh. Okay, well, where were we? You asked a bunch of questions.
What is the
And
capital of Pakistan? It was around this question that you had about how to get a hold of, or how to dislodge these sort of core beliefs.
Right.
Just see here.
Like, I don't, like I'm unworthy of good things, or more like I'm undeserving of, I don't know what it's kind of an insecurity type of thing. And
Oh,
I
sure.
think the insecurity is based on some core belief that, I don't deserve whatever it is, that I'm just being I'm a charity case or whatever,
Right.
Yeah. Especially when it comes to love. And I've told Rachel all about this, and she's assured me plenty of times that that wasn't the case, and and so now I think I've narrowed it down to that belief that I'm a charity case, or that I'm pathetic, or just this pathetic, needy person, or what do you call it? I don't know how to sum that up into something more concise.
The technical term, and I'm not saying that this is a diagnosis, but this would be similar to what you may feel about yourself, is codependent, right? So somebody who doesn't have a strong sense of self and defines themselves in accordance with their relationships and has a hunger for a need for relationships and a great deal of challenge, feeling comfortable or non-anxious in the absence of a relationship, but also the relationship doesn't has pleasurable aspects to it. But is problematic because it doesn't sort of fill the void, if that makes sense. Like it covers it up temporarily, but it doesn't sort of fill
Right.
the void in a complete sense.
Right. There you go. So, yeah, and I guess the I get screwed thing, comes up, come plays into that as well. And and that, and I had that belief a while back that I kept stating that all women were broken, and and I would just kind of set myself up for confirming that.
Right. Got it. Okay. So, I mean, the challenge with all of this is to figure out where it came from, like where it started from.
That's hard to do, and you asked a bunch of questions, and I can't. I have to go back and read these again. You said, was it something you learned about yourself empirically, or was this perspective inflicted on you prior to displaying these traits?
Right. So, I mean, this is how we can differentiate between things which are true about us and things which are inflicted upon us, right? So, let's say that I wanted, and of course I did at one point, want to be an actor. And so I had some very great initial success as an actor and got a lot of great roles and did Shakespeare and so on. But I found that my talent peaked about a year after I started, and I just couldn't really progress any further. And in hindsight, it was, of course, because I had more original things to say than just spend my life mouthing other people's lines, however convincingly. So when it, if I were to say to myself, I'm not a great actor, right, then it's one thing if Tom Hanks says to himself, I'm not a great actor, and it's quite another thing if I say to myself, hey, I'm not a great actor. Tom Hanks, of course, if he were to say to himself, I'm not a great actor, would have lots of evidence to the contrary, which would make it neurotic.
Right.
And if but if I were to say to myself, I'm not a great actor, then I would have lots of empirical evidence that that was in fact a true statement, that I'm not a great actor.
So which preceded the other?
Well, in my case, I wanted to be a great actor. I found that I couldn't be a great actor. So for me to say to myself, I'm not a great actor, is clear, right? So because whenever you start something, like whenever I started singing, it was like, wow, you know, I'm getting leads, I'm getting, you know, because I was a big fish in a little pond. But then, of course, you break into the big time, and then it's like, oh, okay, there are people here who really have great voices. And so you have a sort of limitation on that. But if somebody like Luciano Pavarotti were to say, I'm not a good singer or not a great singer, then he has evidence to the contrary. So when you have an opinion about yourself, which is that I'm not worthy of good things, there's one of two possibilities. Either you started off being worthy of good things and were encouraged to have good things and believed that you did have could get good things, but then and then every time you got good things, you screwed them up. Right? Then it would be based on the empirical evidence, with no no foreshadowing, no implicit assumptions at the beginning of things. Based on just the empirical evidence from a neutral position, it is clear that I am not worthy of good things, because from an encouraged and positive starting position, then I every time I got a good thing, I screwed it up, which means that I'm not worthy of good things. It would be sort of empirical. But if, on the other hand, you started off with everyone telling you, you know, you're a piece of crap, you're useless, you're pathetic, you're, you know, nothing good is ever going to happen to you. So if that happened, or if any time anything good did happen to you, people attacked you, or they took things away from you, or they were resentful, or they ignored you, or whatever, right? Then we have a situation that's not empirical, but is inflicted, right? So to analogize to the acting thing, if I just sort of started out thinking, gee, I'd really like to be a great actor, and so I sort of expressed this desire to my family, and they said, oh, you know, bald guys are never great actors, and you suck, and you've got an unpleasant voice, and you can't, you know, you've got no confidence, and it's all going to go wrong for you, and you're going to end up starving to death, and this and that and the other, right? Then it would be the case that I never really got a chance to find out if I was a good actor, because I would have been kind of crippled from the very beginning, right, in terms of my confidence. So that's sort of the question. When you have a core belief, it's one of two things, right? It's either true or it's not true, but it's it was inflicted upon you, right?
Right. And as far as this example goes, I'm not sure. I'm having trouble comparing it to the beginning.
Well, what that indicates, of course, for you, that it's not empirical, right? That's how we know, right? So I can very clearly remember the first couple of times that I acted, and everyone was like, oh my, you're great, you know, it's really great, and this and that, and then I got more roles, and then I went to the National Theatre School, and I, you know, it was 1% of people who even apply get in, and I thought I was set, and this and that, right? So I can very clearly, and people were, you know, encouraging and positive about what it is that I was doing. So I can remember very clearly back to the opinion that I had about wanting to be an actor, and realizing that, you know, it was a slow realization that I just didn't have what it took to be a very successful actor, and that I could not live the life of a mediocre or even decent actor. Like, I would feel real depressed if I spent my life getting small parts on TV shows or, you know, anything like that. That would sort of suck. And so I can remember very clearly back to a time where I genuinely believed, and not unreasonably so, that I had the potential to be a great actor. So if you can't remember a time when you believed that you had the right to good things, that's how you know it was inflicted.
But how do I remember specific inflictions?
Inflictions of what?
Of I don't deserve a good relationship, or I'm like this, you know, I'm undeserving of a good relationship, or I'm undeserving of
good things in general, right? Of which a good relationship would be one. Well,
right.
Give me an example of something that happened that you were happy about, or that you thought that was good for you, or good in regards to you, from your early childhood.
Well, I do remember even as a child, even in elementary school, I had a lot of crushes and stuff like that. And people would always humiliate me about that, especially like my friends and my mother would give me a lot of crap about it. Like, oh, this is just childish. Oh, stop moping around. Stop being depressed. Stop. I would see them, and then I wouldn't get to see them, and my mom would just kind of reject my feelings about it, and I didn't know what to make of it. It was all new feelings.
Sure, okay. And what was the reason that your mother gave to you for scorning your desire or your interest in a girl?
Well, it's just inappropriate. it's not Christian, or I don't know what it's like. It's shameful to
Okay.
experience. That's it. It's shameful to experience those feelings.
Okay, so and what age are we talking here?
I would say from the age of 9, maybe 8, to till now.
Right. Okay. Okay, so let's take it from the age of 8, and it may have been younger. I remember wanting to talk with girls and being all goo-goo-eyed when I was 6 or 7, but let's just say 8 years old, right? So you're interested in a girl because she's, cute or funny or nice or whatever, smells pretty or whatever it is, right? That's,
Right.
you're interested in a girl, and so you have an impulse to do what? Like to go and talk to her, to walk her home from school, to teach her the to how to Macarena. I mean, what is it that your impulse was at that age?
I really didn't know what to do with that. It was just kind of well, I had these feelings, I had these attractions, and people would tell me, well, that girl's ugly. Or you shouldn't go out, you shouldn't date her or go out with her or whatever they called it back then, going with you shouldn't go with that girl. She doesn't look right, or they didn't meet she didn't meet her their standards or whatever. And these were friends, and then there was my mother, who gave me a lot of shame and guilt about it as well, but that was a whole different kind of thing than what my friends would give me. So
Right.
I don't know, I'm guessing that they were jealous that I had this thing, and I don't even know what it was, really. I would hang out with them, and we would, the whole googly-eyed thing. And I don't I didn't I wasn't even really given a chance to talk to these girls and actually get to know them.
Right. Now we have to, at least for the moment, ditch your friend's reaction as we look at this, because your friend's reaction would have been colored by your reaction to what you were feeling, which itself would have been instructed probably by your mother, right? So the fact that your friends put her down from a practical standpoint, i.e., she's not worthy of you or whatever, she's too fat or she's too short or she's got glasses, all of that kind of stuff would only be possible if you yourself had a negative response to what was going on, right? Because your friends would sense that and sort of feast on it. But that's sort of a symptom, that's an effect. The cause is your mom's, right?
I see, yeah. So they picked up on that. Just
Right.
like they picked
If you
on
feel
Ma.
guilty,
Yeah.
if you, sorry to interrupt, if you feel guilty for something that you're doing, right? Like I remember when I was back working in an office. When I was working in an office, I would be working on the Free Domain Radio board. If I was waiting for a phone call, or if there was just some break, or I was I just got my coffee, I'd check the board before I did the next thing. And of course, then if somebody came into my office, I'd look up, like I'd been caught with my hand in my nether regions or something like that, with a shaved goat under the desk or something. And of course, that's an invitation for somebody who's aggressive, since you've already you already, I was already sort of self-attacking in a sense. I was already sort of frightened because I was doing something wrong, you know, checking the web on company time or something like that. And so if there was an aggressive person around, that person would then realize, just based on the body language and based on their instinctual perception of the interaction, that they could then be... I wouldn't really defend myself, right? Because if I think I'm doing something wrong, then I've sort of opened up a chasm in myself, which other people's hostility and negative attitudes fill in, right? I invite that into my life just by being hostile towards myself or negative towards myself. I invite negativity in. Of course, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and this is how core beliefs are sort of reinforced, right? So,
right, because I would get made fun of a lot for just being weird, and I would be weird just to get made fun of for being weird.
Right, so the way it works is that your mom stabs you, and then other people's attitudes towards you are like the infections that come into that scab, right? But you have to have the wound first, right? The infections can't get through healthy skin.
Right, and I was always treated as though there was something wrong with me, something different about me. I didn't conform correctly. I didn't obey. I didn't.
Right.
You know, I questioned a lot of things, and I asked too many questions. Just, that was kind of weird.
For sure. And of course, that is a mere effect, right? What happens in society is a mere effect of our primary relationships when we're children. So let's go back to your mom and her reaction to your attraction to these. We'll just call them your crushes, right? So you get a crush on a girl. And there were a couple of different terms that you used. The first was inappropriate. And then there was one other which I can't recall. And then the third was shameful. Do you remember that one other in the middle?
Well, the shameful was due to the religious aspect, I think.
Sure.
Where I was experiencing feelings which were inappropriate for Christianity. So that was shameful.
So with her, I'm just trying to understand what was inappropriate for her. Was it that you were too young, that you shouldn't have these feelings until you were 16, or what?
Well, what I gathered is I shouldn't have these feelings until I was an adult and out of the house and gone or married or whatever. Or, you know, I shouldn't have these feelings at all. And they were even shameful, you know, to even have them back then. And I would sit next to these... I think this girl was invited over a couple of times. Once at my birthday party, I'd been sitting there in the chair next to her, and I would, I don't know if I'd hold her hand or whatever, but I would get these in just huge disapproving looks, like of shame, from my mother. And, you know, that was a big no-no. We can't touch. We have to remain at arm's length and all that stuff. And, you know, I had never even kissed a girl till I was like 13 or 14.
Well, you know, to some people that may not be that bad a track record. I don't know what kind of sex-crazed community you grew up in, but 13 is not actually a bad time for your first kiss. It's not unreasonable.
Right, and it wasn't until 19 that anything else happened. So
right, well, that definitely makes you afraid.
Kind of,
no, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm a little bit confused about, and this is just my non-knowledge about, I mean, I was sort of brought up by a liberal sort of German mom, so perhaps a few more boundaries this way would have been better, but I'm not sure I quite understand, like, you're not supposed to have feelings of sexual attraction towards a woman until you're married. That seems a little bit like putting the cart before the horse, because if you are not attracted to anyone and can never act on it until you're married, I'm not sure exactly how you're supposed to end up getting
married.
That.
Right. Yeah, that's the way the Christians think. That's Rachel in the background.
Okay, so did your mom ever show any affection towards your father?
Not a lot.
But some?
Some. They would kiss every now and then. And that was about it. And they would sleep in the same bed.
And did they ever talk about their own courtship, or was there ever any sort of understanding of what it was that sanctified their own desire for each other when they were courting?
No. No talk of dating. Although there was a time, I think, when I found a picture of my dad's ex-girlfriend or something, and that was quickly brushed under the rug.
Right.
So I at least I grasped the idea that, well, apparently my dad dated more than just my mom
Right,
before
right.
getting married.
Okay, I think I'm starting to get a picture, right? So this is very much it's a pretty antiseptic household, right? So there is not a lot of sense of that there's playfulness and positivity in being attracted to, a girl in your house, and that you should talk about it, and and there was, of course, not any trust in you, right? Because it's like, if I don't scowl at Nate here, then what's going to happen is, what did they think was going to happen? Like, what was the implicit what if they didn't scowl at you?
I have no idea because I didn't even know what sex was at that age. I didn't even know what a penis was for. I didn't know anything.
So you opened your jam jars with your hand, is that right? Just kidding. So,
Yeah, I was 8 years old, so I mean I didn't even hit puberty yet.
okay.
So,
So
yeah.
did you know what like so when you were attracted to a girl, you had a crush. What was the content of that frown, right? What was bad about what you were doing?
Holding her, I think I put my head on her shoulder or put my head on her head or something like that. She had put her head on my shoulder and I put my head on hers. It was that cute little photo you always see in
Oh,
the
yeah.
photo frames. It was just one of those Kodak moments and I got scowled at for it.
Right. And what was your experience of that scowl? Like, what did you feel when your mother scowled at you?
Shame.
For like what was the portrayal? So, and this is a tough question, so we'll take us a bit on it. How did you look in your mother's eyes to arouse that emotion? What did she see in you that was so vile or so shameful?
Desire or affection or what?
No, I just said right.
Oh, I thought you were offering us another word. Desire.
And let's be real specific here,
No.
because I don't think that your mother would say, if questioned, desire is evil, right? Because you can desire to go to church, you can desire to read the Bible, right? And she also wouldn't say affection is evil, right? Or bad or shameful, right? There's something that she saw in you, or saw you doing, or was going to do, that was vile or shameful or corrupt or evil or something like that. And that's why, let's just simmer on this for a little bit, because there's a potent brew of spices in this look, right? This look of condemnation, of shame, of humiliation. So what is it that she's angry or frightened or contemptuous of?
I guess I was being too affectionate. I was showing I wanted to be affectionate with this girl.
All right, so if you went up and wanted to give your mom a hug, did she have the same look in her eyes?
No.
Okay, so we're just trying to tease apart the feelings here, right? And the reason that these feelings are tough to get at is that you're taught not to identify them, right? You're taught not to feel them, right? So we're very much going against your conditioning here, and that's why it seems like pushing a you ask how to lift the anvil, right? Well, the anvil is to get into the feeling, right? So it's not an excess of affection. It's not because you wanted to hug the girl, right? Because hugging is not evil, even, I mean, unless you're a total nut job Christian, which, your mom doesn't sound quite that far. So there's something that's vile in what it is that you're doing, but we're not sure what it is. I mean, we totally know what it is, but we just can't identify it consciously yet, right? So let's go back to the feeling. What is the feeling? Where does it sit in your body? What is the emotion that happens when your mother looks at you that way?
I can't have what I want.
That's not a feeling. That's a very good phrase, but what's the feeling? What's the emotion that occurs?
Crap. I have a list of emotions that I could go through to find the right one. Guilt?
Okay,
Or no.
let's start with where does the emotion show up in your body when you're a kid and this happens? Is it in your hands? Is it in your feet? Is it in your chest? Is it in your stomach? Where does the
What's in
emotion?
my, it would be in my stomach for sure.
Okay, is it composed of something like fear? Is there fear in it?
Yeah.
Is the fear of your mother or is the fear of yourself? And so let me just clarify that question because it's a bit confusing, right? So if a doctor said to me, Steph, you're possessed by nine devils that will cause you to mutilate yourself, I'm going to feel a lot of fear, but it's not fear of the doctor. It's fear of myself, what I might do to myself or what I might do to others. Whereas if you just felt fear of your mother, then you would be far less likely to feel shame.
So I felt fear of what I was feeling,
No,
or what I might do.
I'm not sure that it's exactly fear of what you were feeling because we're trying to get the feeling. If I'm just afraid of my mom getting mad at me, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to hide what I'm doing, right? So if I want a cookie and I'm afraid that my mom's going to get mad at me, but I think that having a cookie is totally fine, but I think that my mom's going to get mad at me, I'm much more likely to just have a cookie. But hide it. Because I don't think there's anything wrong with what I'm doing. I just want to escape punishment, if that makes sense.
Right.
Right? So, if I understand your feeling correctly, the feeling wasn't that what you were doing was perfectly fine. It's just that your mom, for some weird reason, didn't like it. In which case, you would just sort of blush, but just to appease your mom. And then you'd hold this girl's hand under a coat or whatever, right? But you wouldn't feel bad about what you were doing, you just want to escape punishment. Does that make any
Right.
sense?
Right, but I did feel bad about what I was doing, but I didn't know what I was doing that was
Well,
bad, other than
you have to
getting
know
close.
what you're doing. You have to have a standard, right? Because we're getting further here, right? So what happens is you are not just frightened of your mother, right? Because then you just hide whatever you were doing, right?
Right, I'd wait for her to walk out of the room and
Yeah,
then I would,
exactly. You'd go
yeah.
over or whatever, right? Like if your mom doesn't like you listening to a certain song, you don't burn the record, you just put headphones on and say you're listening to something. Like, you know what I mean? Like it,
Right, exactly.
right? So, but you didn't do that, right? What happened was you internalized some standard of your mother's. Right? Because you didn't roll your eyes and say, well, mom's just this freaked out, uptight, religious nut. So who's like,
Yeah.
weird because it's like, oh, what am I doing? I'm holding some 8-year-old girl's hand. Like, what fresh hell am I inventing here, right? There's nothing that I'm doing that's wrong. Mom's just freaked out about it. You didn't just roll your eyes and say that. And I'm not saying that that was even possible in your situation. But what happened was you got infected, right? You internalized a standard of your mother's. And we need to figure out what that's, this is the anvil, right? We need to figure out what that standard is.
That's hard.
It's very hard, and when we get it, it's going to be very easy. But this is the anvil. This is why, and it should be hard, right? Because if it was really easy, then you'd feel like an idiot for not getting it right. So, and you're not an
Right.
idiot, right? You're a very smart guy, so you want it to be hard, right?
The standard.
And that's what I mean when I say your mother looked at you and saw something, saw some aspect. I'm not saying it was there. This is in her mind's eye. She saw you holding a girl's hand, and she saw something horrible, something contemptuous, something shameful, something dangerous, something ghastly. Right? And we need to figure out what she saw in you, because it was that view of you that passed into you.
Sexuality?
Well, that's certainly possible. That's certainly possible. But again, sexuality is not a judgment. That's just a biological description.
Right.
Right? So there is a judgment. And that's what I mean. Your mom can't really, if somebody had come up to her and said, is it evil for a boy to hold a girl's hand? She would have said what?
No.
No, I
Bubble.
agree with you, right? So clearly it's not the fact that you were holding the girl's hand that made her give you this look.
I was getting close to her.
To who?
To the girl.
Close, like you were like, sitting next to her?
Right.
And you put your head on her shoulder?
Right, I was just getting closer, more intertwined like a pretzel.
Okay, so would your mother say that it is evil for a boy to put his head on a girl's hand, on a girl's shoulder, when they're sitting in public?
I don't know. I never asked her that.
Well, but you know your mom, right? I mean, if you don't, then knowledge is impossible. Where were you? Were you in church? Where were you at this point?
This was in the living room at a birthday party with a bunch of kids around.
Right. Okay. So, would your mother say that a boy who puts his head on a girl's shoulder in the middle of a party is evil and is going to hell?
I want to say yes.
Okay, then we have to figure out what the difference is between holding hands and putting your head on her shoulder, because you said that holding, I'm just trying to tease this apart, right? This is the complex neuroses of your mom's that we need to figure out, right?
Right, and I also
something's
have to
okay
figure
with holding hands, but not putting your head on her shoulder.
Right, and I don't even know if I can't distinctly remember what I had done. I don't know if I put my arm around her or if I put my head on her if it was just the putting my head on her shoulder, or if it was what? Closeness. I just got really close. I'm just really close.
Right. Okay.
I started to hug her, I think, or just hold on to her.
Right. Okay. I'll just sort of try and give you a metaphor about what it is that we're trying to get to, because I know I'm totally aware of how horribly complicated this all seems, and it is, right? But in libertarian philosophy, we don't condemn a man for pulling a knife out of his, you know, holster or out of its scabbard, right? If he pulls a little knife out of his scabbard, that's not an evil action, right? It only becomes an evil action if he's really angry and he pulls out his knife while saying at the same time, I'm going to stab you to death, right?
Right.
So it's not the pulling out of the knife that is evil. It is the pulling out of the knife because it is going to lead to a stabbing that makes it a problematic gesture, right?
So she thought it was going to lead to...
Exactly. This is what we have to figure out. Well, this is what we have to figure out, right? What was your physical... Because she can't really... I mean, it would be too insane for her to say, you're not allowed to look at girls, right? At that point, you would have gone, okay, right? This is becoming ludicrous, right? So it's, where did she see this going that she felt she need to nip it in the bud?
Making out.
Okay, so she was concerned that you were going to start, like, French kissing when you were eight, this other eight-year-old girl at a party.
Right. Although, yeah, I don't think I don't know that I did anything that looked like that. I didn't even know what French kissing was.
No, of course you didn't, right? I mean, of course, right? So, if you were if you did end up French kissing an 8-year-old girl at a party, what would happen to her?
Well, people would see that and she would feel embarrassed or right, like a bad mom or like a...
Well, what would they say about darling little Nate, the grabby hands?
That I'm a womanizer or something? I don't know.
Well, it's tough without a woman, but I think a girlizer?
Right.
But that you're like a sex maniac that you may even be possessed by the devil, that we can't allow our children to go over where Nate, Mr. Sticky Fingers, is lurking in the shadows, you know, waiting to pounce on our precious little offspring or whatever, right? But there is a fear that she had of where this was going to go.
And I can't even begin to guess what that fear was, other than that I was just becoming too affectionate for my age or whatever.
Well, again, you have to be very careful with your language here, because your mother would not say that affection is a bad thing.
Right. Too affectionate with a girl my age?
No, no, because your mother would not say affection is a positive thing, right?
Right.
You know, and again, this is a term that I wouldn't suggest that your mother would use consciously or anything like that, but that she would be concerned that you would be grabbing at or molesting this poor little girl who can't defend herself because she was raised properly, or, you know, that there's some kind of gruesome or malevolent intent in what it is that you may end up doing with this other little girl, you know, this little girl at a public party or whatever, right? There's some place that it's going to lead that is incredibly uncomfortable for her, and she is terrified of what people will say.
Right.
Right, so the shame that she is experiencing is not shame at your actions.
She's ashamed of what people will say.
Yeah, she's afraid of the reactions of her peers.
And she was always that way.
Well, all Christians are. I mean, that's the only reason why Christianity exists, is because people are afraid of the judgment of their peers.
Right. And yeah, she was really, you know, what, I mean, she would even say that right out front, like, what would people say?
Right, right.
That was always an immediate concern for her, and I remember thinking all that time that, boy, is she really concerned about what other people think.
Right, right. Right, so your mother didn't have a standard that had anything to do with objective morality or right and wrong, that she was terrified of social shame, of being ashamed, of being shamed socially.
Right.
Right, so when you did what you did, she was afraid of where it was going to lead, which was to her social shaming.
Right, right, for sure.
Now, could your mother logically have come up to you and said, Nate, I'd like you to stop this because I'm afraid of being attacked by other people?
Never.
Well, why not?
Well, because that would be honesty, and, well, that's...
No, but why wouldn't she do that, right? Why would that not be something she could do?
Possibly because it would... It would be undermine her authority or something.
Well, imagine if you're my kid and you want a cookie, and I say to you, Nate, you can't have a cookie because I'm afraid of getting fat.
Well, that would be insane.
Well, of course it would be, but this is how the world works, right? So, if you were an 8-year-old kid and I said, Nate, you can't have a cookie because I'm afraid of getting fat, what would you say to me?
I would say, you won't get fat if I have a cookie.
Yeah, you'd say it's got nothing to do with you, right? I mean,
right.
If you want a cookie, don't have a cookie, right? But that's
right.
Got nothing to do with me.
Exactly.
Right, so we know this is why false premises breed corruption and manipulation and all this kind of stuff, right? So your mother can't say to you, I want you to stop holding this girl's hand or whatever, entwining like a pretzel, as you said, because I'm afraid that I will be judged negatively. Right? And because then what you'd say is, well, that's not right. That's not a right or wrong thing. Like, then she has to ask you as a favor. Right?
Right. Right. It has to be a favor.
Like, I remember when I was a kid, I had hamsters. And I remember taking, I mean, it's so funny, I'm not even that old, but this was close enough to the war that this really, right? So I remember taking my hamster upstairs, and there's this elderly French couple who lived in the apartment building in England. And I opened the door, and I had a hamster in my hand, and I wanted to show this couple, because, you know, this is what kids do. And I was like 6 or 7 years old. And the woman screamed, was completely terrified. And, of course, you find out later that they'd been trapped in France with rats in the war, and you're right, so this really freaked her out. Now, she couldn't say to me, And of course, you know, I remember putting the hamster away, thinking dismally to myself, oh Lord, here comes a big lecture about this, that, or the other, right? But nobody could really say to me, I can't believe you went to show that hamster to this woman. That's evil.
Right.
Right. So clearly what people had to say to me was, well, there's this reason why she freaked out, which you couldn't have known in advance. So you didn't do anything that was wrong. Right. But this is what right. happened. Right. So I wasn't. The people didn't, because it was just too ludicrous a situation, right, for them to try and do that. Of course, this occurred a million other ways in less obvious situations. But they didn't say to me, it's evil to show elderly French women a hamster, right? I mean, that just
right.
didn't make much sense, right?
No.
So the moment that people understand that it's not your job. I mean, everybody knows it's not your job to manage other people's feelings, the same way that if you want to have a cookie, it doesn't matter if your mom or dad is afraid of getting fat, right? That's their issue. So your mom can't say, I feel uncomfortable with you. And who knows, right? Who knows? Maybe your mom was grabbed when she was a little girl by some aggressive boy and it frightened her and it provoked anxious memories. Maybe that was the equivalent of her Paris sewer rats in the Second World War or something like that. Who knows, right?
Right.
But as soon as people say, as soon as our parents say, you have to change your behavior because I feel uncomfortable, then they've just shot themselves in the foot, right?
Right, because then that's it's like emotional bullying.
Well, it's just too ludicrous a response, right?
Right.
It's like you need to buy a car because I have to commute to work. there's such a logical disconnect. Even a 5-year-old kid would understand that logical disconnect, right?
Right. I would have understood the cookie metaphor.
Sure. And you would have even understood if she said, I want you to stop holding this girl's hand because I feel uncomfortable.
Right.
Right? She has to say to herself and to you, not, Nate should stop doing what he's doing because I feel uncomfortable, but I feel uncomfortable because Nate is doing something wrong.
Right. Right.
And they then can't very easily fix on you holding the girl's hand, right? So there has to be this terror of consequences, this fear of a slippery slope. Like, if I allow Nate to hold this girl's hand, the next thing he'll be doing is he'll be holding both their hands. And if I allow Nate to put his neck on this little girl's, his head on this little girl's neck, the next thing that he's going to be doing is he's going to be kissing that little girl's neck. And the next thing, and the next thing, and the next thing, and next thing you know, you're having some Caligula-style orgy when you're 8 years old, right?
Right.
No, seriously, there has to be this terror of consequences, and that you're nipping this in the bud.
Right.
Right, so if you have anxiety, or if I have anxiety about gaining weight and you're eating a cookie and you're my kid, I have to say, eating cookies is wrong because it will rot all your teeth out, it will make you fat, fat people get diabetes, people who get diabetes lose their limbs and their eyesight, so you'll be a person with no limbs, no eyeballs, no teeth, and how would that feel?
she used to use the teeth thing on me a lot.
She used to use the teeth thing?
Yeah, it's like I can go brush my teeth, you know?
Right. No, I know, but people who have problems with aggression usually get wrapped up in teeth metaphors because predator and all that kind of thing. Teeth are a symbol.
Right, and she was a dental hygienist, and my dad's a dentist, so.
Well, there you go, right? So.
Yeah.
Right, so there's this terror of consequences, but even... Right. See, even the argument from consequences is not fundamentally a moral argument, right? So if I say to my kid, you shouldn't eat cookies because you'll end up with like no limbs wheeling around in a box with no eyes and no teeth, right? Then at least I'm not saying it's immoral or evil to eat cookies. I'm just saying, look, I'm exaggerating the consequences, right? Like if you take that first puff on that joint, your head will explode. Right, I mean, it's an argument from consequences. It's not an ethical argument, right?
Right.
Right. So your mom didn't say, "Well, the reason I don't want you to put your head on that girl's shoulder is because boy, you're going to get a venereal disease. Right? Because that would have been an argument from fear and an argument from consequences, and but it wouldn't have been moral. You would have been afraid, but not afraid of yourself. You would have been afraid of the consequences.
Exactly.
But this, what she did, made you afraid of yourself.
I see. I was afraid of my own feelings.
Yeah, you were afraid that you were doing everything wrong, that you were never going to get what you wanted, that everything you did was incorrect, that you were a fool, that you were an idiot, that you were inappropriate, that you didn't know what was going on and everyone else did. Like, there was an existential terror that was injected directly into your spine through these kinds of interactions.
Right, right. Wait, Rachel's not understanding.
Right, right. Oh, she will.
Right, so I grabbed a principle, or like a core belief that I'm not allowed to get what I want.
No, it's deeper than that. Everything you want is wrong.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, and that was the case all while growing up.
Yeah,
everything I wanted was wrong.
Right. Right.
Everything I wanted was wrong.
Sure.
I wanted to quit piano lessons. That was wrong. And when she made me quit piano lessons because she couldn't afford it, or they couldn't afford it, I wanted to start piano lessons. That was wrong.
Right.
It was just everything I wanted was rejected.
Oh, absolutely. For sure. For sure. And this is, of course, I did the recent podcast on how to raise a slave, right? And if this is what you do. You oppose every single instinct that person possesses. And and this is Christianity. Christianity is a virus that attacks self-esteem, right? Because it says everything you want is wrong, right? If you want to have a good meal, that's gluttony. If you want to protect yourself, that's anger. If you have a crush on someone, that's lust. Right, everything that you conceivably could want, every feeling that you could conceivably have, is an enemy.
Right,
it's wrong is, and not just kind of wrong, like impractical, like you want to build a doghouse out of papier-mâché, right? That's just impractical, right? And maybe that's stupid, right? But it's existentially wrong. Every feeling, every impulse, every desire that you have is evil.
Exactly. It's funny, us Texans think the paper mache, the way you say it is funny.
Kind of a gay metaphor, right? Okay.
Right.
You want to build a dog house out of beer cans, how's that?
Right, say it, say it again.
I don't want to be all hat and no cattle, right?
She wants you to say it again.
Papier mache, I don't know why people think that's gay.
Yeah, we never heard it like that.
Y'all don't say howdy or y'all, so.
Yeah, but y'all would pronounce my last name Mulinex.
Yeah, right. Totally.
Mula what? Basil? Yeah. Basil? What the hell is that? Is that a spice?
Yeah, so yeah, all that I wanted was rejected.
No. No,
was
you
wrong.
Precisely
was wrong.
That. Yeah, yeah. Everything that you want is rejected because it's wrong.
Like masturbation was wrong. And every time I masturbated, I had to pray to God for forgiveness.
Right. Not wanting to go to church was wrong. Looking at another girl with, quote, lust, right, having a crush is wrong, right? Your body is wrong. Puberty is wrong. Smelly bits are wrong. Erections are wrong. Hunger is wrong. Satiation is wrong. Drinking is wrong. And everything that you could conceivably want in any way, shape, or form is wrong.
Right. And I remember my first erection. I don't want to go into this on live radio here, but if this ends up on a podcast, but, you know, it's, like, I just remember just it being quite innocent and with my brother in the bathtub and, you know, we were taking a bath and I was kind of young for that, but it was nine.
I got me a torpedo. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, it was one of those funny moments and we were laughing and my brother was laughing and then my mom comes in and says, oh, that's shameful.
Right, of course, of course.
Right.
Right. Everything that you want is wrong. You want a rock and roll album? That's wrong. You want to dress more cool? That's wrong. You want to shine your flashier haircut? That's wrong. I mean, that's religion, right? Everything that you want is wrong.
Exactly.
Right, so how could you conceivably end up with the idea that you can get what you want when everything you want is wrong? Is not just impractical, but evil. Shameful. Because then if you get what you want, you're evil. I mean, what a terrible and impossible situation. You either don't want anything, which is impossible, or you want something, and you're evil. Yay! Well, is there a door number three maybe I could look at? Because I'm not sure I like these ones.
Now that boils up a lot of... That's drumming up a lot of anger and sadness for me.
Well, it's good that you're finally getting in touch with your anger. Just kidding. No, but look, you got to get angry at the right things, right? You got to get angry at the right things. And then, of course, at some point, right, you have to realize that your parents, yeah, they screwed you up and they attacked you and they did bad things and so on. But your life, you have a chance, right? You have a chance. You have a chance to get out of this hell. But they don't, right? They're totally and completely locked into this horrible life and world that they created, right? So you get a chance to heal yourself. Your legs will regrow, right? Your stumps, they will regrow. Theirs never will, right? The vengeance. See, you want vengeance, right? It's part of why you're angry. You want to get them. You want to get people who are wrong. You want to get them, and you want to stomp on them, and you want to do unholy things to them, right?
Right.
Right. But they suffer more than you could ever make them suffer.
Right. They're already suffering.
Yeah. You don't need to lift a finger. Right, you have the power of the conscience is astounding. It's astounding. This is another reason why I say to people, go talk to your parents, go reveal, go ask questions, go be vulnerable to your parents, so that you can see the living hell that they inhabit, and that will help you lose your desire for vengeance.
Right, I see.
Like they broke your arm, but they cut off all their own limbs. Right, so your arm will heal. Their injuries never will. Right, when we suffer harm at the hands of people, we can heal. When we harm others, particularly children, and I don't just mean once with an apology, but in a sadistic or masochistic or brutal manner over years, with no restitution, we are ourselves in hell. We're dead. We're it's a nightmare existence. It's an empty, futile, useless, nightmare existence. And it's a kind of hell that we can't even imagine.
No, right?
That's why I want people, sorry to interrupt, that's why I want people to talk to their family. See what they have done to themselves. See how incredibly anti-truth, anti-joy, anti-connection, see what a lonely, empty, dead cage they are in. And then you can walk away without the desire for vengeance. Like, you know, you get mad at the guys in the airports, the security fascists, as you call them. Well, you're right. Just passing through. What is this, a couple of times a year you have to spend 10 minutes? They're stuck there for the rest of their lives.
Right. And honestly, I was going to say, I haven't been on a plane since 1999, so...
Right, but,
I haven't
but
even
you
been
get
in
mad,
an airport.
Right? You get mad, and this, of course, is partly this sort of religious hangover, right? But, like, I never understand why Christians get angry at anyone because, you know, they're going to go to hell, right? I mean, why would you need to get angry at anyone, right? But you know, the sort of the airport fascists and so on, yeah, they're a pain in the neck. And, yes, it's immoral and unjust what they're doing. But you just pass through. They're stuck there day after under the fluorescent lights doing a useless and repetitive task. You might as well pay people to just dig a hole and fill it back in again because they're doing nothing to protect anyone and they're stuck in this completely empty occupation, which is just a complete nightmare, right? Just think of their lives day in. I'm not saying sympathy, right? But I'm saying that we lose the desire for vengeance once we recognize what happens to these people's lives. I mean, I don't desire vengeance. My mom's conscience has worked out a far more exquisite prison for her than I ever could.
That's pretty enlightening there.
Well, you don't need to lift a finger.
Right.
I mean, that's how you can start to let go of the anger. You think people are getting away with stuff.
Right, they're not getting away with it.
Well, I mean, that's my perspective, and that's what I've seen. But, you know, that's something you can explore within yourself, right? And within your conversations with these people. I mean, are your parents happy?
Right, then it just kind of becomes pity.
Well, I don't go to pity myself. I go to, hey, you know, if somebody shoots their own foot off, they've shot their own foot off. Can I pity them? No, they shot their own foot off voluntarily. That's just what happens when you shoot your foot off. You end up with no foot.
Right.
I mean, I can't pity someone. It's like you picked up the gun, you pointed it at your foot, and you pulled the damn trigger. I can't pity you for that, because you chose that.
Right.
And then, of course, people always say, well, I thought I was pointing not at my foot, but at something else or whatever, right? But that's not true at all. Your mom knew exactly what to do to inflict this kind of shame on you, right? To infect you with her terror of disapproval.
Yes. Yeah, and you do a good Texan accent there.
That's not too bad, I guess. It's North Texas.
I was like, wait a minute, he just did that with the Texas accent.
Oh, thank you. Right, that's the peace of mind that we need to get to, right? Which is that no one's getting away with anything. And even if they are, there's nothing that we can do. Right, but that's sort of the serenity. Other than become free ourselves, right? I mean, if you guys have kids, the solution is in your parenting. The solution is not in attacking unjust people in the world, but in raising just children ourselves, right?
Right. Right. I don't know that I'll do that, but...
You mean have children or raise them justly?
No, have children.
Right. Well, it won't be you. We can get into that in another sort of cast. When the stalk thing is overrated.
Right.
I've got some diagrams. We can go over that. But no, I mean, that's right. That's where you need – that's how to lift this anvil, right, from yourself, is to recognize that your mom was, as I said, talk about in the book, like the Untruth, the Tyranny of Illusion book, right? Your mom was demanding that you manage her emotions, right? That you stop doing things that were making her anxious, but she didn't ask it honestly. Right?
She wasn't vulnerable. She didn't come to me and say, "Now I have these crazy emotions when you do this. It's kind of irritating to me. I know it's, you know, I know it's crazy, but can you do me a favor and not do that?
Do me a solid, you know? Just don't do
right.
that." Like if we're driving in a car and you're singing some song and it's kind of getting on my nerves, I don't say, "It's satanic to sing that song. It's evil to sing that song." You know,
right.
Every desire you have, both musically, sexually, romantically, career-wise, intelligence, educational, philosophical, religious, spiritual, theological, universal, any feeling that you have is completely and totally evil. Right? I mean, that's a bit of an exaggeration to, "That song's kind of getting on my nerves. Can we maybe switch the soundtrack a little?"
Right.
Right, so your mom, there's this metaphor in The God of Atheists that I've always liked, right, where Terry tries to stand up for himself and Dave just gets completely enraged. And I said it was like a mountain falling on a little fern.
I remember that.
Right, but that's how our parents treat us. I mean, this is how powerless they feel. Like, no one will ever have more power in the world than a mother has over her little boy or little girl. That's the greatest power differential on the planet. And so when you have a lot of strength, you don't need to use it, right? You just need a little touch, a light touch. Because there already is so much strength, right? You see some prison guard screaming at a prisoner. It's like, dude, he's a prisoner. He's not going anywhere. He's got to do what you say. Oh, it's the same again. It's not quite the same to say a kid is a prisoner. But parents have so much power, and we so much want to please our parents when we're kids, right? That's our survival strategy, and it's not a bad thing.
Right.
But parents, we so much want to please them. A little light touch, right? If your mom had come to you and said, "Ooh, you know, there's nothing wrong with what you're doing, but this kind of community, that people are going to get mad at that. They're going to get upset at that. And let me tell you why, and you know, yeah, it makes me a little anxious too," but you would have absolutely done differently.
Exactly. I would have understanding, you know, I would have understood and at least, you know, wanted to to do it and not felt bad about it. I would say, okay, this is kind of crazy, but.
But okay, yeah, we all have idiosyncrasies, yeah. Right? I mean, let's, you know, Christina has a comfortable temperature zone of about 0.7 degrees. So, you know, if we're ever putting the AC on or warming it up, or, you know, then she'll hit me with her toes and it's like getting stabbed with the spear of ice from Hades. Right. But I mean, there's just little idiosyncrasies that she likes onions on her food, but only for flavor, and then she pulls them all. I mean, just things that you have to live. I mean, that's fine. We all do that. I mean, that's natural, really? Right?
I do the same thing.
Yeah.
With
freaky planet of onion haters. Anyway, onion lovers and haters, you're like bisexual onion people. I don't know what the
fuck. Right. Right.
But so then it would just be like an idiosyncrasy. But instead, right, when she could have gotten what she wanted from you just by being reasonable and asking nicely, and it would have been much better and so on, right? What she did was she pumped you full of all of this shame and fear and self-loathing, and everything you feel is wrong, and every instinct you have is satanic. And I mean, that's just nuts. I mean, that's like, you know, imagine there's some wrestling thing. I use a nice Texan metaphor here, right? There's some wrestling thing, right? And the Hulk Hogan is going up against Gary Coleman, right? Or Danny DeVito, right? And he comes in with a machine gun, Hulk Hogan.
Right.
You'd say, dude, you're already going to win. Right? We know
it's
that.
Like those, it's like those, you know, hunters that want to use assault rifles on deer.
Oh, well, it's like hunters who want to call in an airstrike.
Right, call in an airstrike.
It's like, what are the deer going to do? Fight back? So parents right. who use this kind of, I mean, you need, and I can say this with some mild authority, just having been a daycare teacher for so long, but you need just a very, very light touch with children, because the power differential is already so great that you don't need to call an airstrike in when you're hunting a little fawn.
Exactly.
Right. So this level of hysterical bullying that occurs because your mother feels that she is worthless. To have a light touch with people is a sign of self-esteem. When you hysterically bully and frighten children, it's because you feel that they don't care enough about you to want to do something just to please you.
Right.
That you're not worthy of people just treating you well. So you have to hysterically go over the top and bully and cow them and nag them and, you know, whatever, right? But that's a sign of incredible self-hatred and self-distrust.
So the way that you kind of hit on the core belief there, she felt unworthy of being treated well.
Oh yeah, for sure. She couldn't ask you, right? She couldn't ask you, listen, I got this weird thing about you nuzzling the neck of like little girls. Could you just hold off and we'll talk about it and this, right? That would be somebody who has self-esteem, who's willing to be vulnerable and say to their kid, listen, kid, you know, this is crazy, but if you could do me a solid, that would be great. Right. To be vulnerable, to risk rejection, to ask for something. But these people don't have the self-esteem to ask for something. They have to bully and storm and scream and guilt and manipulate. They can't just say, listen, can you do this for me, please? As a favor. Because they don't think they're worthy of any favors. They don't think that anyone is going to treat them well.
Right, and that explains a lot in my relationships that...
Well, sure. I guarantee you that you're a person who has a tough time asking for things.
Right.
Rachel, can I get a hell yeah?
You said I have a tough time asking for things.
Yeah, so do I.
Because I'm used to being bullied for things instead.
Yeah, I'm the same way.
Right.
We're both kind of like that, so we just kind of dance around each other and hope that the other one will offer.
Well, that's great. Right. You know, that's going to be great. If you do have kids, that'll detonate that whole system. So you might want to work that out before then. But I know
right. We're working on that as we speak.
It's very hard. You know, when I ask for things from people, I still get emotional sometimes. Like even after all these years, right? Because I'm asking to be treated reasonably. I'm asking, and that's really painful.
Oops, sorry, that was my phone.
No problem. Steph's still talking. Just put some music on. And the reason that I say this about your mom, that you know, to recognize the incredible crater where her self-esteem should be, is not to give you a shred of sympathy for your mom. I mean, that's up to you. But just to understand the empty hell that she's living in and the self-hatred that causes you to bully a child with existential horror. How much do you have to hate yourself to think that's the best way to get what you want, is to terrify children? An 8-year-old boy.
Like that coworker I was talking about of Rachel's wanting, you know, telling her child, there's my voicemail, telling her, her child had stolen the BlackBerry from her aunt.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and this is, like, imagine if Hulk Hogan climbs into the ring with Danny DeVito and also brings a gun and 3 buddies. How strong does Hulk Hogan think he is?
Not very.
Not very, right? When we over-exaggerate and become hysterical and bullying and contemptuous and use these existential arguments from hell like religion, it's because we feel so incredibly weak and powerless and self-loathing that we can't imagine that anyone would ever like us enough to do something because we asked them to.
And they're kind of weak because of religion, right?
Yeah, well, everything we're talking about here is wrapped up in religion for sure, but bullying is always a sign of impotence, and we are all aware of that, right?
Right.
And children is insane, right? So this is just when I say nobody gets away with anything, right? The moment that you bully a child and then don't apologize, you've just sealed up your tomb, and that's it. I mean, you never get free, you never get happy, you never can be healed, because now she's done something, particularly all these years later, that can never be undone, right? She can never go back and give you a better childhood.
Right, and I guess when you do that, you're constantly confirming your own belief that you're not good enough.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Of course, you are creating a situation. You feel, well, no one's ever going to do what I ask. And moms get into this all the time. Dads do as well. But moms get into this all the time. My kids never listen to me. They don't do what I want. And they scream at them, right? Well, you've created that situation, right, by not dealing with them reasonably.
Right. Right, exactly. Yeah, this is all just becoming extraordinarily clear.
That's excellent. Well, I'm very glad. Look, I'd mull over that feeling, because we didn't quite crack that, and that's okay, but I'd really mull over that feeling that occurred for you when your mom gave you that look, right? Because that we can't really get that over the phone, right? That sort of takes a little bit of time. But in all of that, right, packed in all of that is the core belief that everything you want is wrong, and therefore you're never going to get what you want, because if you want it, it's going to be wrong.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's all connecting, like the little neurons in my head are just connecting with each other.
Right, it's like that other, it's another good metaphor. Sorry, these metaphors are all in, I just booked the editor for The God of Atheists today, so I was reading over some bits of it. And it's like this, there's this metaphor when Joanne is thinking about her marriage. It's like watching a city from a hill as the power comes back online, right? Like these grids start to light up all over the place, and that's what philosophy and this kind of connection work can do.
I see. Yeah, and I remember you. Yeah, that book is full of metaphors. You definitely mastered that.
Metaphor.
I've been trying to incorporate my own, trying to think up metaphors, and I'm getting better at it.
Yeah, no, it's just a freaky thing that I can do. You know, like how some people are triple jointed, that's just one freaky thing that I can do.
Right. I think you have a natural talent at it, and I'm just kind of trying to develop something.
Right. Well, listen, I'm gonna, if you don't mind, I've got to jump to get something to eat, but I've been trapped up here in the Red Room of Tangential Truth because Christina's had patients, but I'm going to grab something to eat. I'll post this just for you. Have a listen or whatever. I think this would be fantastic for other people to hear, but have a listen and let me know what you think.
All right, will do.
All right, thanks, man. Have a great time this weekend. I'm sorry I can't be there.
Me too.
All right, but maybe what if you guys get to some place? If you going to anyone's place there, or are you guys just meeting in general?
Hotel Sachs. We're actually gonna meet up with Greg, John, which is Freebie on boards, and Ned. Ned hasn't been around in a while, but I get him on AOL Instant Messenger every once in a while. And we're all meeting up at Pazano's, I think it's called.
Okay. Well, if you guys want to give me a shout, just let me know, since it'd be fun to chat with everyone in the room.
That'd be cool.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Well,
talk
to you
soon. Thank you very much.
All the best, Rage.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.